White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. Welcome to the 46th episode of our study hour on this 9th of May, 2013. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and
I'm Hadding Scott.
And tonight we're bringing you Chapter 41, Jews Use the Peace Conference to Bind Poland. This is a really good one. We talked about Poland last week and this commission to Poland. Right, Hadding? And yes. Now he's going into more detail that I think is even more interesting than what we had in covering what the commission came up with. They make some very, very good points here. So let's see. It's about an average length of one of our shows, so we have time to do quite a bit of commentary if we want. We'll just see how it goes. Right, Hadding?
Well, sure.
Okay. Well, I'm ready if you are.
Okay. Chapter 41. Jews use the peace conference to bind Poland. There is one difference between the Polish report of Sir Stuart Samuel and those of the others, which illustrates a difference between the Jewish mind and the general mind. The type of mind represented by the other investigators, Captain Wright, Brigadier General Jadwin, Sir H. Rumbold, and even Henry Morgenthau, is the type of mind which looks behind events for causes. Here is, for illustration, trouble between the Jews and other people. It is a continuous situation. There is always trouble between the two. We seldom hear of it, however, until the Jew begins to get the worst of it. As long as the Jew remains on top, making the Gentile serve the Jewish plan, there is no publicity whatever. The Gentiles may complain as much as they like, may protest and rebel. No international commissions arrive to investigate the matter.
Well, I have to break in already because I think this opening is so powerful, and that there's trouble between Jews and other people. Continually, Jews cannot get along with other people, or they cause trouble in their relations, and they're in other people's countries and they're causing trouble. I mean, that's enough right there to say, okay, we've had enough of you. Get out. You know, out with you. But no, you know, all these games are played, you know, trying to pacify the Jews. But anyway, to me, this is point number one, that this is so important, should be made often. I think I just have 2 points, but I could probably create more. This is so important that we need to, and you know what they've done, of course, they have taken this trouble that they cause with other people all the time, and turned it into anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
You know, and actually, as I was thinking about this, anti-Semitism does not really exist. There is no such thing as anti-Semitism. Although I like to use the word, but still, you know, since it's in play and what it means and so on, but it is just a reaction to Jewish troublemaking.
Yes.
And demands, okay.
Trouble between the Jews and other people is designated as trouble only when it begins to grow inconvenient for the Jew. It is then that he sends the cry of persecution around the earth, though the plain fact may be that he is only being nipped at his own game. The Poles saw how the Jews clung together in the most admirable teamwork a minority absolutely controlling the majority, because the minority formed a close corporation and the majority did not. So the Poles said, "We will take a leaf out of the Jews' own book. They work cooperatively among themselves. We, therefore, will work cooperatively among ourselves." Which they did. And at once the cry of persecution resounded loud and long. Propaganda was begun against the good name of the Poles. More resentment followed. Regrettable violence ensued, and the dispute still continues. Jewish reports of these disturbances rarely go beyond the fact that Jews are suffering from certain acts of the Polish populace. Incident after incident is given with full detail, and with a very apparent journalistic appreciation of horror. Names, dates, places, and circumstances are all in order. Very well. It is no part of this article to deny or minimize the suffering of Jews, wherever or for whatever cause it may occur. There is nothing whatever to be said in extenuation of injustice inflicted on the humblest human being. The murder of even one person, the terrorizing of even one family, is a very terrible thing to contemplate. It is a great pity that the world has become so accustomed to the piled-up tales of horror that it no longer has any sensibilities left to feel the shame and degradation of these things. From the days of Belgium onward, all races in Europe have suffered, and by sympathy, all races in America have suffered with them, though it is a fact that we hear more, far more, about the suffering of the Jews than of any other people.
Okay, now I have to ask, Hanning, what do they mean by from the days of Belgium onward? Of course, I thought of World War One, but
yes.
That didn't start there. So that's where those tales came from of atrocities, right?
Well,
but
there was a very heavy focus of atrocity propaganda on Belgium during the First World War, what the Germans were supposedly doing in Belgium.
Yeah, bayoneting children, cutting off their hands or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I thought that was a strange way to put that in here. It's kind of hard to figure out that's what
bayonet it is. Baby tossing.
Yeah. So you think that's what it is?
Well, probably. This kind of propaganda goes back beyond the First World War, but probably not in the same intensity.
Yeah, this was right after the First World War, so.
Yeah.
Okay.
There is, however, this reaction of the practical mind. Why do these things occur? Grant that robberies, assaults, and murders described in the complaint have occurred, why should they occur? Are the Polish people naturally given to perpetrating such acts? Have such acts marked the residence of the Jews in Poland for the past 800 years? And if the Polish people are not naturally abusive, if the story of the Jews' residence in Poland has been mostly pleasant, what causes the change now? That is the way the practical general mind works. It seeks to know the background.
Well, I like that very much. That's point number two. it's important to always look at the background of any of these questions, and that's exactly as they say here, that the Jews don't want us to do. They don't want anybody to do that, and they try to stop it.
Mr. Morgenthau, apparently, put in too much of this background, though at that he put in very much less than the other investigators, except Mr. Samuel. Therefore, Mr. Morgenthau's report was pigeonholed by American Jewry because the facts make very poor material for the kind of propaganda which American Jewish leaders had in mind. Apparently, they did not dare publicly to criticize or renounce his report. They simply passed it over. Captain Wright, who endeavored to put in all the background he could find to make Polish conditions comprehensible to the British people, has been handled insultingly by the Jewish press. They don't want investigation. They want sympathy for themselves and denunciation for the Poles.
Well, now this is exactly the way it is with Holocaust. See, Holocaust is just another one of their complaints about atrocities against Jews, you know, just on a much bigger scale because it was part of World War II and they're able to make it into something huge. But it's the same thing. They don't want investigation and they stop investigation into it. And again, they succeed at doing it because of the way their control is so in so many crucial places, not just media, but other places too.
Well, sure. All of this stuff being said about Poles in 1921 could just as well be said about the Germans 10 years later, 20 years later.
Right. And I mean, it's just what gets me, I get so angry that they keep getting away with it, and they're getting away with it today, in 2013, still. They shouldn't be, but there's something wrong with us that we can't overthrow these people, I guess.
Well, it seems that a lot of people are more suspicious of news reports than they've ever been since 9/11, you know. Lots of people are suspicious of almost anything that happens.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I mean, it's all we can do is...
In America, we are inclined to believe that every condition is explainable. It may be reprehensible, but it is intelligible. We believe that the explanation is the first step toward the remedy. Mr. Morgenthau does not speak of pogroms at all. In this, he sets an example that certain hysterical American Jews ought to follow. The present series of articles in the Dearborn Independent is a pogrom. Some Jewish spokesmen speak as if each separate article were a pogrom. In the hectic but uninstructive oratory of Hebrew Lodge meetings. But Mr. Morgenthau exercises more precision in the use of words. He says, "The mission has purposely avoided the use of the word pogrom, as the word is applied to everything from petty outrages to premeditated and carefully organized massacres." Oops. Wait a second.
No, that's right. Where you lost your place?
Lost my page there for a second. Mm-hmm. On one point, all the reports agree, namely that the unjust killing of Jews has been on a scale so much smaller than that alleged by the propagandists that there is no comparison. In that part of Poland, where war disorder was less common, 18 persons were unjustly deprived of their lives. For the whole territory during the entire period when it was being overrun by various elements, Sir Stuart Samuel admits, apparently with reluctance, that he can count only 348. Captain Wright says, "I estimate that not more than 200 or 300 have been unjustly killed. One would be too many, but taking these casualties as a standard with which to measure the excesses committed against them, I am more astonished at their smallness than their greatness." Sir H. Rumbold says, "If the excesses had been encouraged or organized by the civil and military authorities, the number of victims would probably have been much greater."
You know, maybe we should go over who these characters are again for the listeners to this program, that Morgenthau was head of the American delegation, and they don't have him in here much. Jadwin and his friend Johnson, who helped him, were a part of that, and Colonel Wright was a part of that, and this Sir Samuel guy,
Captain Wright,
yeah, and this Sir Samuel Wright is the British.
Sir Stuart Samuel,
yeah, is the British, and along with him goes which guy goes along with him? There's another British fellow.
Rumbold is British.
Yeah, Rumbold. Is Rumbold British? And then there's another one, though, that has a British. Well, anyway, so there's two. These are the people that we're talking. And the two main guys are Samuel and Morgenthau, both Jews, and who had each delegation. And Samuel is the one that is most trying to fit with the program of the Jews, whereas Morgenthau did a much more neutral job.
Less so. Biased, but this article points out that Morgenthau doesn't give as much background information as the others.
Right. Yeah, that's right. So there again you go. You know, it was the non-Jews who were very concerned with getting all the background in, which, the Jewish elite were just, that's why they, the other point that was made last week is that they just sat on their, you know, kind of hid their reports and never gave any publicity to them.
Yeah.
Right.
That the reader may see how the various reports run with reference to specific charges of brutality, the agreements and divergences are set down below. Look at the reports concerning what happened at Lemberg. And Lemberg, by the way, is the German name for Polish Lvov or Lviv in Ukrainian.
Oh, that's what they're talking about. Okay. I did not connect that.
Yeah, a lot of these German cities have, or a lot of cities in Europe have a different name in German. Mm-hmm. Like Bratislava is Pressburg in German.
Well, right, and, because they at one time were German.
Yeah, and Louvain in Belgium is Lüttich, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, they have German minorities in a lot of those cities, and they call it by a German name.
But when the boundaries were changed, then the new owner, you know, changed it to the name in their language, and that's what's used officially.
Okay. Let's see. Number one is, these are points covered in the different reports. One, the excesses occurred November 21st through 23rd, 1918. The city was taken by Ukrainian troops formerly in the Austrian service. And that's according to Samuel, Morgenthau, Wright, and Jadwin. They all agree on that. Two. General Monchursky raised a Polish army about 1,500 in number, consisting of men, women, boys, some of them criminals, and after a severe struggle succeeded in capturing half the city, the other half of which remained in the occupation of the Ukrainians. And that's Sir Stuart Samuel. A few hundred Polish boys, combined with numerous volunteers of doubtful character, recaptured about half the city and held it until the arrival of Polish reinforcements on November 21st. That's Morgenthau. When the German troops revolted all over Poland at the time of the armistice, and the whole edifice of German organization fell to the ground in a day, a few Polish officers raised a small volunteer force in Lemberg, numbering between 1,000 and 2,000, which was composed of boys, roughs, and criminals, and even women in uniform. For nearly a fortnight, they fought in the streets against the Ukrainians and, on the arrival of a similar force, drove the Ukrainians out of town. "This was really a splendid feat of arms," says Captain Wright. 3.
The Jewish part of the population of Lemberg declared itself to be neutral,
Sir Stuart Samuel says.
And think about how damning that is, though. You know, they live in Poland. They're supposed to be Polish people. But now there's a dispute between the Poles and the Ukrainians, and they become neutral.
You know, I saw an article in the Jewish Daily Forward a few days ago about Jews in the South, southern USA. And the article said that the Jews who had been in the South for a while were neutral on the so-called civil rights thing in the 50s and 60s.
Huh.
They stayed out of it.
Well, that's what
Jews
they do.
In the rest of the country gave them a hard time about it, but they stayed neutral, which has the effect of undermining the white position.
Well, right, it does, and they stay neutral so that whoever comes out ahead, they'll join up with them. They won't have alienated them.
All right. The Jewish population declared themselves neutral, but the fact that the Jewish quarter lay within the section occupied by the Ukrainians, and that the Jews had organized their own militia, and further, the rumor that some of the Jewish population had fired upon the soldiery, stimulated among the Polish volunteers an anti-Semitic bias that readily communicated itself to the relieving troops, says Morgenthau. During the struggle, the Jews proclaimed themselves neutral, but though I do not think they gave any armed resistance to the Ukrainians, their neutrality was highly benevolent to the Ukrainians and probably helpful. They thought the Ukrainians would win, says Captain Wright.
Yeah.
Samuel.
In the result, none of the military commanders responsible for these events had been punished. Has been punished.
This is number 4 now, right?
We're on number a different 4. Right, theme. 4. Yeah. In the result, none of the military commanders responsible for these events has been punished, said Samuel.
As early as December 24th, 1918, the Polish government, through the Ministry of Justice, began a strict investigation of the events of November 21st and 23rd. In spite of the crowded dockets of the local courts, where over 7,000 cases are now pending, 164 persons, 10 of them Jews, have been tried for complicity in the November disorders, and numerous similar cases await disposal. 44 persons are under sentences ranging from 10 days to 18 months. Aside from the civil courts, the local court martial has sentenced military persons to confinement for as long as 3 years for lawlessness during the period in question, says Morgenthau.
Well, now, so he is contradicting what Samuel says, right? Because Samuel's trying to say that nobody was punished for this. No military commanders were punished. And Morgenthau is saying, oh, no, you know, they were, the Polish government, even though they were overloaded with cases and so on, they were trying to take care of these two, and they did take care of them. You know, it's a slow process, but it's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Speaking of the general subject of punishment, Captain Wright says, the government has inflicted a good deal, though an insufficient amount of punishment. These punishments it has never published for fear of Polish public opinion. And Brigadier General Jadwin of the United States Mission says, if complaints as to slowness and uncertainty of military and government punishments and relief were heard, as they were, it seemed nevertheless to indicate that orderly process of government was in operation. 5.
No compensation has been paid for the damages done, Samuel.
Well, I love that one because, see, right away, they expect to be compensated. You know, all kinds of people suffer damage in all kinds of ways all the time, but these people, every little tidbit, you know, they add up and they expect to be compensated for everything that happens to them. first
this
thought.
Mission is advised that on the basis of official investigations, the government has begun the payment of claims for damages resulting from these events, says Morgenthau.
Payments had begun to be made in Vilna, Pinsk, and Lemberg before our departure from Poland, says General Jadwin.
So is Samuel just lying? You know, and he's just being a propagandist. And that's what the Jews want, you know, or the international Jews want, and that's why they liked his report.
Well, I think maybe he's sort of bending the truth a little bit. You know, they talk, Morgenthau and Jadwin talk about how the process of making reparations had started.
Okay, yeah.
Samuel's maybe oversimplifying the case.
Yeah, right.
The occurrences in Lemberg were bad enough, to be sure, but Sir Stuart Samuel let it be understood that all the blame rested with the Poles. The other investigators gave reports that explained the matter, although no report could excuse it. And all but Samuel agreed that the Polish government did what it could to repair what had occurred and to prevent recurrences. This from the American report is worth considering. General Jadwin was present at the taking of Minsk and a personal witness of the strenuous efforts of the military authorities toward preventing acts of violence. The fact seems to be that as soon as any sort of order could be brought about out of the chaos of war, the disorder ceased. And yet we read, even today in our newspapers, of thousands and tens of thousands of Jews being slaughtered in Poland. Further, to indicate that these events did not occur without Jewish provocation, to a certain extent, there is the case of Pinsk. This was on April 5th, 1919. 1. Pinsk had been recaptured from the Bolsheviki a short time before. The population was overwhelmingly Jewish, only 25% being Polish, according to General Jadwin and Captain Wright. The Polish officer had only a very small detachment of men, and the Bolshevist lines were quite close. The Polish officer was treated with coldness by the Jews, and he suspected them of friendly relations with the Bolsheviki. He was very anxious. He had posted notices that any unauthorized meeting would be punishable by death, says Captain Wright. 2. The government organizer of cooperative societies had given permission for the Jewish cooperatives to meet for discussion of the plan to join other cooperatives, according to Samuel, Morgenthau, and Wright. 3.
It seems that 2 Polish soldiers and another soldier informed the military authorities that they had information that the Jews intended to hold a Bolshevik meeting on Saturday in what is known as the People's House, being the headquarters of the Zionists. Samuel.
This meeting took place in the offices of the Zionist organization, which is very anti-Polish, said Wright. It is recognized that the information of Bolshevist activities in Pinsk had been received by 2 Jewish soldiers, Morgenthau says.
The town commander, with judgment unbalanced by fear of a Bolshevik uprising of which he had been forewarned by 2 Jewish soldier informers, said General Jadwin.
After the meeting had ended and been formally closed, a great many members of the cooperative association remained in the same room talking together. Other members of the Zionist organization, including ladies, were in the room at the same time. This collection of people must have presented the appearance of a meeting, and I think the members remaining in one room were numerous enough, technically, to constitute a meeting. There was some insolence in this, and the previous behavior of the Jews. Sir Stuart Samuel pointed out to the witnesses that their authorized meeting itself had been a breach of the Sabbath, and therefore a grave religious offense, said Captain Wright. All of the investigators agree in denouncing what followed. Captain Wright says the Polish officer would hardly have acted with such promptitude if the prisoners had been other than Jews. General Jadwin sums it up thus: the Pinsk outrage was a purely military affair. The town commander, with judgment unbalanced by fear of a Bolshevik uprising, of which he had been forewarned by two Jewish soldier informers, sought to terrorize the Jewish population, about 75% of the whole, by the execution of 35 Jewish citizens without investigation or trial, by imprisoning and beating others, and by wholesale threats against all Jews. No share in this action can be attributed to any military official higher up, to any of the Polish civil officials, nor to the few Poles resident in that district of White Russia. Sir Stuart says, under the present local administration, Pinsk is once more peaceful, and the relations between the Christian and non-Christian inhabitants have become normal. It is sometimes forgotten here in the United States that for Poland, the war is not yet over. Poland is now a free nation on paper, but her freedom seems to be a day-to-day tenure, dependent on fighting. Bolshevism made serious inroads on her. Wherever the Bolshevik Red Armies swept across Poland, the Jews met them with welcomes. This is no longer denied even in the United States. It is explained by the statement that the Bolsheviki are more friendly to the Jews than are Poles, a statement which readers of our recent articles on the Jewish character of Sovietism can well understand.
A nation within a nation. That's how they're behaving.
Sure, with foreign allegiances.
Yeah, and doing what's good for them.
When the Poles beat back the Reds, they commonly found that the Poles had already set up that the Jews had already set up Sovietism, as if they had long awaited it and were well prepared. It is scarcely strange, therefore, that the Poles still retain their suspicions. The Jews do not want to become Poles.
Now there's a definite statement.
That is the root of the present difficulty between the two peoples. Sir Stuart Samuel barely touches it.
On several occasions, the resentment of the soldiery and civil population was aroused by the Zionist claim to Jewish nationality as opposed to Polish nationality.
Mr. Morgenthau goes a step further. This had led to a conflict with the nationalist declarations of some of the Jewish organizations, which desired to establish cultural autonomy financially supported by the state. Mr. Morgenthau, you will observe, gives a wider peep into conditions. But the best description of the situation is given in the report of Captain Wright. There, the Jews' party program in Poland is to have all Jews on a separate register. The Jews thus registered are to elect a representative body of Jews with extensive powers of legislation and taxation, e.g., it could tax for purposes of emigration. This body to be handed over by the Polish state a proportionate amount of money to spend on Jewish charitable and financial institutions. Besides this separate organization, a number of seats proportionate to their numbers to be set aside in every local and in the national legislature. A sixth or seventh of the Polish Diet to be occupied only by Jews, to be elected only by Jews. Some Jews also demand separate law courts, or at least the right to use Yiddish as well as Polish in legal proceedings. This is the practical program, but the ambition of the advanced section is national personal autonomy, granted in the Ukraine by one of the ephemeral governments of the Ukraine, the Ukrainian Central Rada, on January 9, 1918, and called the Statute of National Personal Autonomy, of which I have a copy. It organizes the Jews as a nation with full sovereign powers. The Ukrainian banknotes were printed in Yiddish as well as in Ukrainian.
You know, I think that Jewish nationalism was more, probably because there's more Jews there, was stronger in Poland than any other of those surrounding countries. I mean, even later in the late 30s, early 40s, a lot of this stuff that was happening was coming out of Poland. And then it was influencing others, or the Polish Jews were going around, traveling around and, you know, telling other people. But then, you know, this Ukrainian business, it sounds like it was a temporary thing. And in 1918, they got a kind of a government that was, you know, real Jew-friendly, Bolshevik-type government. And they gave Jews all these kind of rights that they wanted. But it's just amazing what they're demanding here.
Sure.
Yeah.
They'll take whatever they can get.
Well, and they work it all out, and they don't have any shame or any you know, they're not concerned at all with how they look. I don't know why. No wonder people hate them so much. And then they, you know, it's crazy.
People sometimes ask, where is the proof of the program of the protocols? It is everywhere the Jewish leaders have attained power, and everywhere they are striving for power. The protocols can be written out of Jewish rabbinical writings. They can be written out of Jewish tendencies in the United States. They can be written out of Jewish demands in the Balkans. They can be written out of Jewish achievements in Russia. They represent the Jewish program, ideal and real, at every stage of modern history. Do you ever hear of this Jewish program in Poland when you are invited to sympathize with the 250,000 Jews who are being brought from Poland to the United States? Will these people leave their ideas outside New York Harbor? Incidentally, Captain Wright's full investigation of the Jewish program may throw some light on the refusal of the American Jews to circulate his report, although it was attached to the report of Sir Stuart Samuel, which is being so widely circulated. However, that his government at home might fully understand the situation, Captain Wright draws an illustrative parallel. If the Jews in England, after multiplying their numbers by 20 or 30, demanded that Jewish Board of Guardians should have extensive powers, the Jewish Board of Guardians, including the right to tax for purposes of emigration, and that a separate number of seats should be set aside in the London County Council, the Manchester Town Council, the House of Commons, and the House of Lords, to be occupied only by Jews chosen by Jews, that the president of the Board of Education should hand over yearly to the Jews sums proportionate to their numbers. If some were to demand the right to have separate Jewish law courts, or at least to be allowed to use Yiddish as well as English
in the King's Bench and Chancery Division. If the most advanced even looked forward to a time when Bank of England notes were to be printed in Yiddish as well as in English, then they might well find public opinion, even in England, less well disposed toward them. In view of this state of affairs, it cannot be regarded as a fact of minor significance that the Jewish investigators, who must have known all this, virtually concealed it, and that the other investigators brought it forth to general knowledge. Neither is it of minor significance that the Jewish press has absolutely suppressed these facts, even while pretending to give the results of the British mission's investigations. Insulting references have been made to Captain Wright's report in a Jewish publication of the better class, because he made references to certain practices which are common among the Jews in Poland. It may be said, however, that the references made by Captain Wright are in great restraint compared with the number given in the recent book by Arthur Goodhart. Whether Mr. Goodhart is a Jew or not, the present writer cannot now say. He is a fellow of Corpus Christi College, Cambridge. He is lately Captain United States Army. He was transferred from the Army at the suggestion of Mr. Morgenthau to act as counsel for the mission, and he says on page 161, "After dinner, Mr. Morgenthau attended a meeting of the B'nai B'rith Lodge, the only chapter of this Jewish organization in Poland. No branches had been permitted in Russia before the war, as it was a secret society and therefore illegal in the Tsar's empire. Major Otto and I, not being members, walked around the town." Mr. Goodhart, as counsel of the American mission, makes an excellent witness as to the kind of people who are coming in such large numbers to this country. But their sense of their own political importance and power is the principal point for Americans to consider. That Arthur Goodhart, his middle name is Lehman, and he was born in New York City. Those could be reasons why the writer here says he's not sure if he's a Jew or not. But, you know, there are some non-Jews that have those Jewish middle names, like Morris Seligman Dees and Colonel something Mandel House, right?
Yeah. Well, you know this, but he is not being very Jew friendly here, is he?
He's criticizing them, that's for sure.
Yeah.
The peace conference did not tend to bring unity in Poland. It rather established the disunity for as long a period as the Treaty of Versailles remains to rule the world. The reader has just seen Captain Wright's description of what the Jews demanded. Let the reader now understand what the peace conference decreed. Poland is prohibited from having an election on Saturday. Poland is prohibited from having a registration on Saturday. The Jewish Sabbath is established by law, and government and courts must govern themselves accordingly. Do what you like on Sunday. Order elections on Sunday, as the Poles sometimes do. But not on Saturday. It is the Jews' Sabbath. Quote, Article 11. Jews shall not be compelled to perform any act which constitutes a violation of their Sabbath, nor shall they be placed under any disability by reason of their refusal to attend courts of law or to perform any legal business on their Sabbath. Poland declares her intention to refrain from ordering or permitting elections, whether general or local,
to be held on a Saturday, nor will registration for electoral or other purposes be compelled to be formed on a Saturday. Close quote. What the Bolsheviki did in Russia, the peace conference did in Poland, established the Jewish Sabbath. And he means officially recognized the Jewish Sabbath. The people who saw this strange setting up of Jewish customs as a part of the law of the land, one of the authorities for such actions being the President of the United States,
Wilson,
are now flocking to the United States in large numbers. Is it unreasonable for them to believe that if the President of the United States could bind Poland to Jewish custom, it is all right to bind the United States too? Moreover, the Jewish separate schools were established by law in Poland. The Jewish separate schools were established by law in Poland. Poland's great trouble has resulted from her lack of schools in which all the population could imbibe Polish ideals expressed in the Polish language. The peace conference authorities, the peace conference authorizes the continuance of that sort of that source of trouble. In Article 11, the Jews were mentioned. In Article 9, the term used is Polish nationals. The reader will save himself a great deal of misunderstanding in the perusal of European news if he will translate the clause racial, religious, and linguistic minorities to mean simply Jews. They are the minority that is at the bottom of most of the difficulty, and they are the minority that is most heard of. It was this minority that dominated the peace conference. Quote, Article 9. Poland will provide in the educational system in towns and districts in which a considerable proportion of Polish nationals other than Polish speech are residents adequate facilities for ensuring that in the primary schools instruction shall be given to the children of such Polish nationals through the medium of their own language. In the towns and districts where there is a considerable proportion of Polish nationals belonging to racial, linguistic, or religious minorities, these minorities shall be assured an equitable share in the enjoyment and application of the sums which may be provided out of public funds under the state, municipal, or other budgets for education, religious or charitable purposes, close quote. But even that is not all. The Polish state is to hand over the money. The Polish state is to hand over the money, but the Jews will distribute it. Quote, educational committees appointed locally by the Jewish communities of Poland will, subject to the general control of the state, provide for the distribution of the proportional share of the public funds allocated to Jewish schools in accordance with Article 9. Close quote. It is most amazing how racial minorities are dropped the moment money comes into view, and the definite term Jew is substituted. More than all this, quote, the United States of America, the British Empire, France, Italy, and Japan, the principal allied and associated powers on the other hand, on the one hand, and Poland on the other hand, close quote. So the text of the treaty begins, together make of all these special privileges not a national agreement on the part of hard-pressed Poland, but an international demand on the part of the League of Nations. Article 12 stipulates that all the agreements affecting, quote, racial, linguistic, and religious minorities, close quote, which is mere diplomatic camouflage for Jews, shall be placed under the guarantee of the League of Nations. This lifts the Jews in Poland completely out of Polish obligation. All they will have to do is to complain to the League of Nations, and international Jewry will do the rest. The United States was a party toward the writing of these stipulations into the treaty. The American people are not yet a party to their enforcement. There are a quarter of a million of these Jews coming to the United States from Poland. You have read their demands in Poland. You have read their achievements in the peace conference. Do you say, as an American citizen, that you are ready to take for the United States the dose of Jewish medicine which the peace conference gave to Poland? Do you say, in view of what has been said about the whole situation, that the Jews are showing anything besides a wicked and gloating spirit of revenge in the way they have propagandized against Poland after humiliating her in the peace conference?
End of chapter. Yeah, end of chapter. November 6, 1920. How come it's gone back to 1920? I must have been absolutely wrong about thinking that we ever got to 1921. I've got a few things I can do. You got anything you want to say about this?
Well, right at the end? I think that the article oversimplifies a little bit, because there were substantial other minorities in Poland, including, as we all know, huge numbers of Germans. And also Ruthenians and Kashubians. And Poland, as set up after World War I, was loaded with ethnic minorities. It was really grossly oversized as a territory for the Poles.
Mm-hmm. Right. It was. And so, and that's when they started. You know, they're talking here because they're looking at it a certain way in 1920, but they're talking here about how the Jews mistreated the Poles. But you know, after World War I, the Poles started lording it over their minorities, and got worse and worse, particularly toward the Germans. So. Yeah, that's a good point you make. Although, you know, this is called the International Jew, so that's what they're looking at. But, you know, back up here when they said that the separate schools were established by law. Now, here again they say Jewish separate schools were established by law in Poland by the peace conference. Do you think that the other minorities got their separate schools too? With their own language?
I'm not sure. I read a news report from September 1939 that implied that the Germans within Poland had been very positively disposed toward Marshal Pilsudski, who had been the dictator of Poland that died in 1935. So I'm not sure how it was for Germans in Poland prior to the late 1930s. Not sure.
No, but me either. I know Hitler liked Pilsudski and thought he was someone that he could work with. I didn't know about the people. But I guess, you know, he was considered one of the best leaders that Poland's had. But I'll just say that Jews in Poland have come out. I've read things that they're blaming the Nazis, the National Socialists, when they got into power there for not allowing them, after 1939, for not allowing them to go to the regular schools and, you know, keeping them from going to school. And the Jewish schools closed down and so on. It sounds like they wanted their own schools as long as they could had control there, they wanted to have Jewish schools. Then when they didn't have the control, when the National Socialists came in, and then they wanted to go to the regular schools. So they're all, you know, they're always switching around as to what they, you know, what they're asking for.
Depending they want to have on, all the options.
There you go. Yeah. They want all those options. Exactly. They do want all options open to them.
Even though nobody else gets that many options.
Right. Now, what else? What else about this? They say they have this wicked and gloating spirit of revenge, and this is very clear. Well, the peace conference. Okay, they make a lot out of that peace conference. That was very close to when they were writing this, and it was still, you know, they were still feeling the effects of it. But yeah, this peace conference, this it turned out to be the worst thing. In fact, it was the beginning of World War II. You know, I mean, they just did such a poor job. And when I was looking for pictures today, looking at all these actors, particularly the big three, the Clemenceau, he was the worst of all. And yes. Wilson and the British guy, what's his name?
Lloyd
George, yeah. You know, prancing around and so on. You think, these dopes, what do they really know? You know, when we allow a few people who are so imperfect to be dictating everything like this and have the right to do so, it just makes you sick. And they're white people, too. You know, whites have made so many mistakes. When you look back at what we've done, it's just pathetic. It's pathetic that they couldn't have done a better job when they had all the power. You know, we say now that we don't have, we don't have any political power. Well, at one time, the white majority idea was acceptable and there was all this political power. And what was done with it? It was just thrown away. Of course, it was this infiltration of Jews and their ideas and so on that caused that to happen. I think it's right that, Henry Ford says, is that the Jews they had a plan for how they wanted to make the peace work for themselves, and it's obvious from that they wanted the war. They had a lot to do with how the war went, and then they were planning on how they were going to work things out to their advantage after the war all along. Well, I yakked through that space of time we had. Any comments on that heading?
Well, I take a slightly more complicated view. The one presented by Brooks Adams in his Law of Civilization and Decay, which is that you have a social change that takes place that opens the door for Jewish exploitation. When a society becomes plutocratic and corrupted by plutocratic tendencies, and where you have the rich people against the common people, that really opens, and where having money becomes a sign of your personal worthiness, that opens the door for Jews to come in and take over. Because at that point, the nation is divided, and the Jews can beat everybody at that plutocratic game. Because everybody else is playing as individuals, and they're playing as a team. That's one reason.
Yeah.
But they're old hands at being economic men.
That's right. Well, thanks. Thanks, listeners. We'll see you next week.
Rage, rage, rage on, breaking out drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.